Welcome to My PT Podcast, the podcast dedicated to bringing insight and encouragement to the rehab community. I'm your host, Devin DeBoer, physical therapist, and today I'm joined by Dr. Scott Hadley of the Hadley Clinic. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And Scott, I always like to start with kind of the story of, you got a really interesting background, PhD to go into physical therapy school. Love to hear that story of how you first got into physical therapy and made that transition.
Okay, yeah. It all started probably back in the early 90s when I was an undergrad.
Okay.
And I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, you know, like everyone does at that stage. Mm-hmm. And I was at Grand Valley State University, and they had a PT program. And so I started to do all the prerequisites for physical therapy school. And probably my third year, I got into a cadaver lab. It was the 400 level cadaver lab at Grand Valley.
I know exactly
what
you're
in. Dissection course.
Yes, yes.
And it just lit a fire in me, and I loved anatomy.
Okay.
And I became a TA. And then my senior year, they were short on lab instructors, so they asked me if I would be an instructor in a lab.
Wow.
And I was still an undergrad. And at that point, I decided I didn't want to be a PT, but I wanted to go to medical school. So I took the MCAT, applied to a couple medical schools, got accepted at Wayne State University and University of South Florida. And then I started, you know, doing the whole medical school preparation thing. And there was a program in Grand Rapids at that time where you could shadow a physician. I don't know, that probably still exists.
Yep.
Basically, I followed a resident around for a couple days,
mm-hmm.
and I observed this guy's life, and it sucked.
Like 16 hours a day?
Oh, man. He was working like 100 hours a week.
Oh.
And now I think they've passed some regulations
where they
can't work that much for, mm-hmm. you know, in their residency, but at the time, he was working 100 hours a week, and in one of the few minutes that he had to sit down and chat with me, he said, "Hey, if there's anything else you would rather do with your life, do it." Because
as a resident, he's telling
he told me that. And his exact words were, "Don't ruin your life."
Not exactly a ringing endorsement for med school.
So I went back and talked to my pre-med advisor, and I'm like, you know, I'm having second thoughts about this. I've already been accepted at Wayne and at USF, and I had taken the offer at Wayne State University in Detroit, and my advisor had a PhD in anatomy, and I already knew I loved anatomy, I loved teaching anatomy, and he said, look, if you love anatomy...
Who's your advisor, by the way?
Tim Strickler.
Oh, yeah.
You know him?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Loved him. Yes.
he said, you know, physicians don't really get to practice very much anatomy, unless they're a surgeon, and then they get really good at anatomy of one body part, and that's about it.
Yep.
And so I decided to go through the process of applying to the graduate school at Wayne. And at the time, there were maybe three or four programs in the country that had a classical anatomy education where you'd take gross anatomy and microscopic anatomy or histology, embryology, cell biology, and neuroscience.
Okay.
So those are the five core topics within an anatomy PhD. Mm-hmm. But only a few programs around the country were actually offering that classical program. A lot of the programs at that time had started converting to cell biology departments, including University of South Florida.
Oh.
So when I was deciding whether to do a PhD program or not, I talked to them and found out that of their anatomy department, only one of them had a PhD in anatomy. The rest of them were cell and molecular biologists. But I wasn't interested in that.
Oh, yeah.
So I ended up having to take the GRE, had to reapply, even though I had already been admitted to the medical school.
Really?
Yeah, and the anatomy department is part of the medical school. So I had to go through the whole interview process with the PhD anatomy program.
Okay.
And anyway, long story short, I ended up getting in. And it was a funded position, so they paid me like $1,000 stipend every month to do my PhD. So better, it was great.
Better than PT school.
It was so awesome. Yeah. So I left, you know, with a PhD in 1998, and didn't have any, you know, debt from that.
Sure.
Yeah. So the when I was an undergrad, I was also involved in a research program with spinal cord injury patients.
Okay.
And that was because I was interested in PT at one point, but it really developed an interest in the mechanisms of plasticity within the spinal cord.
Okay.
And as an undergrad, I had started reading some of the literature on plasticity. And one of the things that drew me to the PhD program at Wayne State was this guy named Harry Gashgarian, who was one of the nation's spinal cord injury research leaders. He was doing some really cool work on plasticity. And so I ended up getting into his lab when I started the PhD program.
Cool.
And but I had a real passion for spinal cord injury. I didn't really know why. I had never known anybody who had had a spinal cord injury. It was just something that really interested me. And so during my PhD, I did a research project on rats. It was an experimental model of spinal cord injury where we would perform a really focused lesion on the spinal cord at the C2 spinal cord level under a surgical microscope. It was very detail-oriented, and suture them back up and put them in recovery. And I did 2,000 of those surgeries.
2,000? Holy. Yeah. You do it in your sleep, I bet.
Yeah, I could probably still do it. Yeah. And so I finished my PhD in 98 and had published three papers in spinal cord injury by that time. And then I had some really cool offers for postdoctoral research fellowships. One was in Zurich, Switzerland, and another one was actually down in Florida, and I ended up turning both of those down because I really loved teaching anatomy. And so I took a teaching position at Hope College, and then the following year I got back into Grand Valley to teach anatomy as a professor.
Oh, really?
My alma mater. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And my office was right next door to my former mentors, Tim Strickler and Brian Curry.
Yeah.
So I was there for 4 years, and then I was still doing a spinal cord injury research program, working with people who had quadriplegia, so they were all had, you know, cervical injury, tetraplegia, I guess by today's nomenclature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was an exercise program, where you've probably heard of functional electrical stimulation, FES.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So back in the 90s, there was a company that developed a stationary bicycle with an FES computer on it. And you put these people into this stationary bike and strap their legs in, and then put electrodes on their glutes, their quads, and their hamstrings, turn the machine on, and this thing would, you know, trigger their muscle contractions to coordinate the pedaling motion.
Wow, cool.
And so they'd pedal this thing for a half hour, and even though they were completely paralyzed, many of them had zero sensation and zero motor control, their muscles were doing all the work.
Sure.
So their blood pressure would go up, their heart rate would increase, they'd sweat, and they'd have all the physiological benefits of exercise.
Perfect.
Yeah. So it was really cool. And in the process of that, I was collaborating with some of the professors in the PT department.
Okay.
Dan Vaughn and Barb Hugenboom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to get to know those guys and was becoming less and less satisfied with a faculty position. Even though I loved teaching, I didn't like the other pieces of being a professor.
Okay.
And so I decided to, I think I was, what, 32, 33? Yeah, I finished my PhD when I was 27, and then so I must have been 33, and I decided to resign from my tenure track anatomy position. This, you know, perfect scenario job. I resigned and went to PT school.
Well, how many people did the head scratcher?
I'm sure a lot of people. Yeah, and it didn't make any sense for me to do that. I mean, my my wife was pregnant with our second child when I started PT school.
Oh, my.
He was born 1 week after PT school started.
What a courageous move.
And then my third child was born during my final year of physical therapy school. So
wow.
It was really taxing on the family for me to, you know, be on rotations. And
oh, absolutely.
And I was still teaching part-time, you know, in evening classes, so... Anyway, PT school for me was just about survival, and honestly, I felt like I was really just paying for a license. I learned a lot. Don't get me wrong, I learned a lot in physical therapy school, but I was taking all of this physical therapy, you know, concepts and putting it onto my knowledge base
of
anatomy and neuroanatomy and embryology and microscopic anatomy.
It is the root of everything.
It's the root of everything. Yeah. And I found physical therapy school really easy because, you know, talking about arthrokinematics of a joint.
Yep.
Well, if you know all the anatomy of that joint, it's the rest of it doesn't, it's not hard.
Right, exactly.
You know?
But see, all the rest of us did not have that good base root, right? So we are trying to master both of those at the same time.
I know,
right?
yeah. And I saw that happening. And so I never rubbed it in.
Nobody said, I hate you.
I never told anybody I didn't have to study for kinesiology or biomechanics. I would just attend the lectures and do a little reading and go take the test.
Right.
And anyway, so I entered the PT profession in 2007.
Okay.
Having a PhD in anatomy and a doctorate in physical therapy. I was the first graduating class of the DPT program.
DPT, okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
And I knew I wanted to do something different because even though I had a deep appreciation and respect for the way PT was being done, there were some things that just didn't make sense to me.
Such as?
In terms of the treatments that were being offered during my clinical rotations, it seemed like, you know, in a lot of cases, people had pain, but that pain was frequently ignored. And instead, they would, you know, be given some modalities and be put on a stationary bike or a treadmill to walk. But I didn't see anybody really trying to fix the painful source.
Mm-hmm.
Until I went on my third clinical rotation, where I worked with a really awesome manual therapist who's in private practice in the Muskegon area now. Robin Isaacs is his name. And he was trained in South Africa. And so a little bit more of a European model of, mm-hmm. of manual therapy. And he just opened my eyes to the fact that, oh, wow, I guess we actually can take people's pain away in many, many cases. So I really started devoting myself to trying to figure out how to do that. If somebody comes into my office with patellofemoral pain, for example, I would like them to leave with their knee feeling somewhat better.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's not the goal in a lot of clinics,
mm-hmm.
Because the whole biomechanical model of physical therapy is that this patellofemoral pain is here because there's weakness in the glute med,
yep.
or something like that.
Yep.
And so it's going to take us 6 weeks to build strength in that glute med, and so this pain might not be gone immediately.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
So consequently, somebody goes to physical therapy 10, 15, 20 visits, and they're not feeling better. And that always frustrated me.
Mm-hmm. What's the point?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I'm like, this is, you know, mm-hmm. people are wasting their time and their money, and
mm-hmm.
it's just frustrating to the PT, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes, absolutely.
And the research supports what I just said. You know, there was a study recently published, I think it was last year, comparing the outcomes of adolescents with patellofemoral pain and adults with patellofemoral pain. At a one-year follow-up, only 25% of those people actually felt like their symptoms were any better 1 year after receiving PT.
Wow.
And that's really disappointing.
It is, yeah.
And that's what I was starting to see in my clinical rotations when I was in PT school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I really wanted some more training in manual therapy. So I took a position with a company that would teach me, you know, some of the ropes about manual therapy.
Where was that?
It was health, motion, physical therapy.
Okay.
And so I worked there for a year. And during that year, I started developing some of my own theories.
Okay.
And these theories were, different than the theories that they had there. And and so I decided I needed to go off on my own because...
Did you take any...
they wanted me to practice their philosophy, and I was developing a different philosophy, so it was time for me to go.
Did you attend any continuing education courses that helped solidify that theory at all? Your own therapy. Did you take any continuing education? Did they send you anywhere to help?
They did it all in-house.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
And what was their training background then?
One of the owners, the founder, was actually from the Netherlands. So he had a very European model of manual therapy.
Like Kaltenborn type
stuff? Some Kaltenborn and some Bobath and Yanda.
Okay.
Yeah, very much Yanda based.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. If this
For anyone who doesn't know Yanda, Yanda is basically the European version of Florence Kendall.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
He was this... In fact, I think he actually had polio.
I think he did, yes.
And that was part of his interest in the...
Yes.
You know, in these crossed patterns that he identified...
Yep.
But, you know, he talked a lot about, and this actually leads to part of my philosophy, is I actually purchased this thing called the Yanda Compendium, which is all of his works. And he talks about phasic and tonic muscles and how when a phasic muscle fatigues, it basically kind of loses its tension. But when a tonic muscle fatigues, it actually becomes more tense. And that really intrigued me, and I started looking more at how he identified these tonic muscles, and it turned out most of those tonic muscles were muscles that only crossed one joint, the soleus, the vasti muscles of the quads,
okay,
the gluteus medius. I think he wasn't sure about the glute med, but I put it into that tonic category, and postural muscles of the spine.
Sure. Right.
So essentially, these are the muscle groups that allow us to stand upright. Even if our muscles fatigue, they don't lose their tension.
The brain wants to stay upright.
Yeah. So I like to use the analogy with my patients. Like, you know, when we're talking about a muscle like the soleus, for example, if it fatigues, the nervous system stiffens it. It causes it to tighten up. Imagine the opposite scenario, though. Like, let's say the soleus was a phasic muscle, like the muscles in your forearm, where you're holding a 5-gallon bucket of paint. And after like a minute, you start to lose your grip. And after another minute, the thing drops because these phasic muscles that, you know, are performing fine motor activities in your hand, when they fatigue, they lose their tension. Mm-hmm. And so their contractile strength is, you know, gradually reduced until a point where they just let go.
Mm-hmm.
The tonic muscles don't do that. The tonic muscles, when they fatigue, they stiffen. And it's a neurological phenomenon. So the soleus, for example, if the calf becomes fatigued, like in a runner, if the soleus muscle becomes fatigued, it actually gets stiff, so that you don't like slump down on a heap on the ground every time your muscles get tired. You can still stand upright.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people are walking around with some really stiff tonic muscles in their legs and spine, their soleus, their quads, their glutes, and their paraspinal muscles will get really stiff. You know, and that actually produces a lot of issues. So that's basically the philosophy that I was starting to develop.
Gotcha.
And I do want to give Health Motion credit for that, because some of it was just based on the stuff that I was learning there.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
And I started to feel kind of bad when I was diverting from their treatment strategy.
They gave me the foundation.
But it led me, it led me to a different place.
Sure. So then you decided to leave, and you started your first clinic.
Yeah, so I decided to leave, and I started a clinic with a friend of mine, we graduated together.
Okay.
And we opened a clinic in Easttown.
Okay.
And that's when I worked with Adam Fujita.
Okay. Yeah.
But that partnership just didn't work. Partnerships can be really tough.
Yes.
There's certain things you don't know until you get into it, you know. And
it's like
so,
a bear, yep.
So we parted ways after about 9 months. And I went and started my own place, which I called Hadley Clinic.
Okay. Full, you try to get insurance from every... You were not, at that point in time, you were accepting everybody?
Yeah, so that was in 2010. And at that point, my goal was to get in with all the insurance companies.
Gotcha.
And I wasn't totally successful with that. I could never get in with Priority Health, which is one of the big payers around Grand Rapids.
Exactly, yeah.
And so that actually taught me something really valuable, because even though I didn't bill Priority Health insurance, I offered this complimentary consultation program where you could just come in for a free consultation. I'd spend 20 minutes with you, check things out, tell you what I thought was wrong, four visits or whatever.
Sure.
Every time somebody would come in for one of those consultations and they had Priority Health, they would, 9 times out of 10, literally, they would say, well, how much will it cost for me just to come anyway?
Really?
Yeah.
How cool.
Yeah. So even from the day I opened my door in 2010 for the Hadley Clinic, about, I don't know, anywhere from 20 to 40% of my patients were Priority Health patients who were paying me out of pocket.
Much of those are covered lives around here. They have a huge percentage. So that makes sense.
Yeah. And it wasn't really my intention. It's just I just couldn't get in network with Priority Health for some reason.
What was their reasoning, by the way?
They said they had enough providers.
Yeah.
But I took Blue Cross, Medicare, all the other insurances, Cofinity, Aetna, United Healthcare, all those.
Mm-hmm.
So I, carried on like that for several years and started hiring
a couple
of
employees, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, after about 6 months, I hired somebody part-time. And then maybe a year later, I hired 2 full-time people, a full-time office person. And so, I was marketing the clinic as fast-acting manual therapy.
I like it.
Yeah, and so it's like, we're not going to put you on a 12-week strengthening program hoping that you feel better at the end of the 12 weeks. We're going to do what we can with our hands to mobilize muscle, mobilize other soft tissues, mobilize joints, whatever, to restore your body's alignment, to restore muscle balance, and at the same time, take you through a conditioning process. I call it the ABCs, alignment, balance, and conditioning.
Okay.
And and it was quite successful. Even once I started teaching these other new grads that had worked for me, the philosophy that I had was transferable to them.
Sure.
And they could pick it up and they mm-hmm. learned it and they did well mm-hmm. with it. At one point then I had there were 3 of us in the clinic and then a full-time office person. So mm-hmm. I never really wanted it to be huge. It wasn't my intention to build a, multi-clinic company.
And as we previously discussed before we started recording, your philosophy is you're one-on-one with your patients. So there is no tech, there's no athletic trainer,
Right.
So your therapist had one-on-one with their patients all the time.
One-on-one. And very low-key on modalities, too. You look around my room here, there's no ultrasound machine.
No.
There's no hot pack.
No.
Percolator, whatever those things are called. every once in a while, sometimes I'll just tell people, go home and put some heat on it or go home and put some ice on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't do that here.
There's a wonderful skeleton, though.
Great skeleton.
He's turned at us.
Yeah. So I really believe strongly in the right form of manual therapy and the right exercises.
Okay.
And that's what I taught my clinicians when they worked for me too.
But today you've transitioned out of that structure model into a different one.
Yeah. So 3 years ago I made around 3 years ago I made the decision that I was going to start getting out of my insurance companies. So I dropped everyone except Medicare and Blue Cross about three and a half years ago. And the reason I kept Medicare is because I had to. And the reason I kept Blue Cross is because they were still reimbursing what I felt like I was worth.
Gotcha. Okay.
A lot of the reimbursements were, dipping down below $100 for 4 units, and that mm-hmm. didn't seem right to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept Blue Cross and Medicare, maintained those for about a year, year and a half. And then a year and a half ago, when I moved to my new location, I dropped Medicare and Blue Cross too. So I don't bill Blue Cross at all. I don't bill any insurance, and I don't see Medicare patients unless they have something that's not medically diagnosable. So if they have a medical diagnosis, I'm, you know, obliged legally to bill for their services. But if they're just here for wellness, I can bill for that.
Yep, gotcha. Yeah.
So and that's a fine line.
You can define things how you want. Yes.
You know, when you look at Medicare terms, it's like, okay, prior level of function, is their activity functional? In other words, can they walk half a mile? Yeah, they can walk half a mile. So therefore it's not a medical diagnosis if they can walk, you know, however far Medicare thinks they should be able to walk.
Sure. So obviously Priority Health taught you that valuable lesson that people are willing to pay for their own health and be the driver of making the decision of where they would like to go.
Yeah.
Because Priority Health was steering them towards other clinics, right?
Yeah.
That's a very courageous step to go, I am not taking any insurances. Walk me through that. Were you confident at the time, or were you like a little fear and trepidation?
Well, by the time I dropped them entirely, half of my patients were already paying out of pocket. Because I had started dropping some of the smaller insurance companies, and I never had taken Priority. From the time I started, 20 to 30% were already paying me out of pocket.
Okay.
And then, you know, 3-4 years ago, up to half of my patients were paying me out of pocket.
Okay.
And I wasn't charging a ton. I was charging $90 for a half-hour treatment, which actually is, you know, more than you can get from an insurance reimbursement.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when I dropped Blue Cross in Medicare, I actually upped my rate to $130 for a 40-minute treatment, roughly.
Okay. And how do you feel somebody contacts you?
Mm-hmm.
What do you typically instruct them in, inform them of? Because it's a non-traditional model. How do you get past that barrier?
Yeah. There's a perception among people who use the healthcare system that people who don't bill insurance are probably offering a higher quality product. And it's this consumerism that we've all been trained in. We know, okay, I could go buy a new car for $17,000, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be a cheap car that isn't going to be awesome looking and not fast.
Serviceable.
And, yeah. You know. Or I could spend $50,000 and buy a really nice car.
Yes.
That's going to last me a long time. It's going to get better mileage. It's going to just, it's a much better quality car.
Right.
Now, if I can afford that $50,000 car, I might do that, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do.
Sure, yeah.
We see a lot of $50,000 cars on the road.
Yeah.
We also see a lot of frugal people who could afford the $50,000 car but choose the $17,000 car, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and it's just a matter of choice. But some people just place a higher value on something that costs more.
Okay.
Right? So, if somebody calls me and now I have on my website, I don't bill insurance, you know, word is out, everyone knows I'm cash practice. So most of the time when someone calls, they've already been to my website, they already know what my fee is. And so it's not even an issue. Last week though, and this probably happens once a week, I get a phone call or an email. Hey, I just want to know, you know, if you'll work with my insurance company. That's the first question a lot of people ask, you know. And so by the time I got around to calling this guy back, he had actually been to my website. And he said, hey, I was on your website and I saw that you don't bill insurance. And that's totally fine. I still want to come to you.
That's awesome.
Because you came highly recommended. That's
what
he said. So most of the time, I don't even have to sell it. And I've actually come to the point where I don't try to sell it. Because when I try to sell it, a lot of times it just feels like it's...
You're getting salesy.
I feel like
you're pushing them into a decision they probably don't want to make.
Or it feels like I'm discounting myself by trying to sell something. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? No, I am that good. Yeah. Come on, really?
That's true.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it feels like I'm trying to convince myself, you know?
I didn't look at it that way. That's a beautiful way of looking at it, yeah.
Oh. Now, I do know that there is a awesome Facebook group run by my friend Aaron LaBauer called the Cash PT Nation.
Okay.
He's got, like, I think 5,000 members in this Facebook group. And he's been running a cash-based practice for several years. And he's on this path of teaching other PTs.
Aaron LaBauer. Put those in the notes, yeah. How do you spell his last name?
L-E, capital B-A-U-E-R. And he's trying to teach other PTs how to do a cash practice. And he's got a great sales pitch, and he's really killing it. You know, he's doing a great job. And he's teaching other people to do a great job.
So if somebody comes to you, let's say a good friend of yours is ready for a change, or they might be frustrated with the current system of insurance or mm-hmm. where they're working, what steps would you tell them to take if they were going to decide to make a cash-based decision? They're like, I really mm-hmm. like what you're doing there, yeah. Scott. Can you walk me through?
Yeah.
What would you say?
I did a lecture at the student conclave meeting in the spring.
Oh, you did?
They wanted me to talk about cash PT practice.
Who did?
The student conclave.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
cool.
It was one of the, I don't know, it was a seminar type thing. It wasn't a breakout, continuing education thing. But mm-hmm. What I told them is it's actually quite simple. I mean, you need to understand your market. Like, who are you going after?
Your niche.
Yeah. Yeah. If you are just trying to market to everybody, no one's going to listen to you because they think you're a generalist.
Gotcha.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So choose your market based on what you love. If you love working with dancers, then target dancers. There are thousands of them in Grand Rapids. All these schools of dance, you know, for kids doing ballet, for jazz dance, whatever, right?
High school, whatever.
Target dancers if that's what you love. I mean, and all these older Gen Xers and baby boomers, you know, that are doing Zumba, they all get hurt.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Do, yeah.
It's like they love this dance exercise called Zumba, but they get hurt, because they're getting old.
And right, yeah.
So, you know, if that's what you love to do, do that. If you love working with runners, if you love running, then target that group, because they always get injured.
So get a niche. Know
get
who
a
you're...
niche. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Now, the interesting thing about a niche is that it always will expand from there. So I loved the science of running when I first started my practice. And I love to run. I'm not a great long distance runner. I have more of like a, you know, stockier muscular build. And so, you know, I'll never run a marathon in less than 4 hours. You know? In fact, I'll probably never run another marathon because I don't like running more than 10 miles. But I love the idea of running. And I love the mechanics of it and the way the body can do it, you know. And so I marketed myself to runners. I held workshops, free workshops, you know, come, I'm going to show you how to work on these three muscles, which will improve your running form. And I'm going to, you know, and I actually started my practice during the beginning of the barefoot running era.
Oh, boom.
And so, yeah, so I used to teach people how to run barefoot, you know, safely. And then I would do stupid things like run the resolution run on January 1st barefoot. Which, that was a bad idea. But, you know, so find something that you love and do it. And that the thing, when you find this group of people, they have family.
You know? Yes, they do.
So you work with a runner who has knee pain, and he's like, hey, my wife's back has been hurting. She's not a runner, but could you help her? Oh, yeah, of course I could help her. Send her my way. So it snowballs, right?
Oh,
so I started with this little niche group, or what I wanted to be a niche group, but this niche group has brothers and sisters and children and wives and husbands and parents. And you do a really good job with one person and let them know, hey, I can do these other things too. You know, yeah. I don't just focus on running injuries.
Sure.
So then the funny thing is, you know, well, I remember the first time I had this conversation with somebody. It was actually a guy, a runner's mother. She was like, you know, 65, 70. And it was interesting because she basically had the same issue her son had. She had, it was like an Achilles tendinopathy sort of thing.
Sure.
Okay. He got it from running. She got it from getting older and being out of shape.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the same exact mechanism of injury. Hmm. Overuse of a few key muscle groups. His overuse was caused by running. Her overuse was caused by inactivity and going for a mile walk. But mechanically, it was the exact same issue. Yeah. And so I remember telling her, I'm like, yeah, you know, basically you have a running injury. and I'm going to treat you just like I treated your 30-year-old athletic son. And she was like, ooh, that's great. I love it. So I decided from that point on, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to treat pretty much everybody as if they're an athlete, you know? I'm going to give them...
We all are.
Yeah, right. It's so, like your body moves the same mm-hmm. exact way. It's the same neural pathways. It's the same muscles. It's the same joints. So anyway, so finding a niche is key.
How did you... okay, so that's... Niche is one thing, and then that expands. Yeah. Is there anything else you tell somebody?
Yeah. So in terms of... People always ask, how do you market it? And what I've always found to be the most powerful marketing tool ever is word of mouth.
Referrals.
Word of mouth referrals. Not from physicians. Physicians, man, I've spent so many hours trying to convince physicians to send me people. But the problem is, they're all, you know, orthopedic associates. They have their own clinic.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm.
So even though I graduated from college with one of their surgeons and we were friends in medical school together, I've never received a single referral from him.
Sure.
And that's okay. I get it. You know, I don't need his referrals
mm-hmm.
Because I have something way more powerful than depending on a physician to refer me patients, and that is word of mouth, where I help you with your back or your knee or whatever it is, and you're better in a couple weeks, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. You know, mm-hmm. can you help my wife?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a week later I get a call saying, hey, my son sprained his ankle, you know? And so it's this word of mouth referral.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up treating entire families and relatives and, you know, kids when they come home from college, you know, in the summertime or over the winter. Like I have like 4 college kids next week that are home on Christmas break.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's like, hey, my daughter's home and she has a bad rib. Can you see her? I'm like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, right.
You know? So word of mouth marketing. So you do a great job. You provide a great service. You follow through with what you promised or with what you intended. And if you do a good job, people will come back to you and they'll pay out of pocket for it.
But then you also tell them, hey, if you know of anybody else, love to be able to help them. You always throw that in there when you're...
If I'm starting to slow down, I might like that's like actually like a really heavy-handed sales approach for me.
Okay. I didn't know. Okay.
I mean, usually I stay busy without even having to say any of that. And part of it is, you know, I've been in practice for 9 years now, and so I think there's a little bit of, you know, just people know me now.
People know you, yeah.
And so I don't have to work as hard. I used to be a little more aggressive about, you know, trying to send out a newsletter once a month, which is not aggressive.
Yeah. No, it's
in
not.
In my mind, it's like an aggressive
sales
tactic.
One email a week is pretty aggressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when I start to get a little bit slower, like this time of year, you know, people are just, you know, it's just a hard time of year.
Sure.
So I sent out a marketing email. My second one this year, I sent out last week. And it was just like, hey, you know, this time of year is a little slow. I've got openings. If you feel like you need to get in, let me know.
That's it.
Simple. That was it.
Wow.
if you call me and you need to get in, I can probably see you within a couple days, not a couple weeks.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so...
So you're booked out 3-4 weeks at a time, typically?
I actually try to schedule only 1 week in advance.
1 week in advance,
which
okay.
sometimes gets me in trouble because if it's a real busy time and I'm scheduling people for the following week and then I get 3 or 4 new people that want to come in, it's hard sometimes.
Okay.
I'll just try to make accommodations and work a little more that week.
So how many clinical hours are you here then?
This is going to make you laugh because So I need to preface this. So the work I do is very heavy-handed. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's physical. My hands, and I'll be 49 in February, and my mm-hmm. hands get tired faster than they used to.
Yes.
I have about 35 visits a week in my hands. If I go over that, I get inflammation in my body. Just like I'm like, I can't do this.
That makes total sense.
I don't, it's just one of those things where I don't know if it's age related. I mean, I'm healthy. I don't really have any physical issues, but 35 visits a week. That's about 30 minutes of heavy manual labor, heavy
yes.
manual therapy.
Yeah, that's a lot in those hands.
Pushing a lot through my fingers.
Yes, you are.
So 35 visits a week max is about what I try to see. On average, it's about 30 a week, and those are 45-minute blocks. So you do the math on that, and I work like half time.
I think for a manual load, that's pretty good. I mean,
yeah,
7 patients a day, 3.5 hours of manual therapy, intense.
Yeah. So what I usually end up doing is, and I'll explain why in a second, but I usually try to see those people in 3 days. So I'll work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday from like 8 to 5. And mm-hmm. I can get, 10 or 12 visits in a day.
And it gives your hands a good 4 days to rest.
Yeah, so then I have 4 days of rest. And then I have...
That's great.
Yeah. And I have some time to work on some other
sure.
adventures that I'm starting. So...
Cool.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, you have some continuing education courses that you are interested in.
Right, yeah.
In developing?
I started teaching my approach in my first clinical, my first clinic that I owned with a partner, I taught him the approach and our first employee the approach. And so we were using that in my first clinic, which, like I said earlier, it didn't last too long. But so that was when I really started thinking about teaching how I do it. And then when I started, off on my own and hired some employees, I taught them. But it's an approach that I call neuromechanics PT. The term neuromechanics is not my term. It's actually a subdiscipline of the biomechanics field. And it's a really interesting combination of neurophysiology and traditional biomechanics. And what a lot of biomechanics labs are realizing is that, we can talk about torques and vectors and mm-hmm. all this stuff of motion, but really the kinetics of motion is not only determined by the nervous system, but that kinetics of that motion influences the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our movements are actually reflexes. So we think about walking as a voluntary motor activity, and it certainly can be, but most of the motor recruitment, the timing and the contractile force, is not voluntary. It's not volitionally driven. It's driven by subconscious involuntary reflexes that we might not have any control over.
Anybody who teaches somebody how like a total knee patient to walk again knows that once they start thinking about it, it gets really ugly.
That's true. Yeah, we see it with total knee patients. Now, the reason I can say it's 100% reflexive, unless we consciously override it, is because that's what we see in research studies where, like, this was learned maybe 80 years ago. In a decerebrate cat model, where they basically cut the spinal cord, then they'll put this cat on a treadmill, and the cat will walk perfectly normally, because walking is a spinally mediated reflex, which is turned on by certain mechanical triggers. And this is one thing I saw when I was doing research on spinal cord injury. I didn't tell you, my very first job was actually in rehab, spinal cord rehab. And we had these patients on these body weight support treadmills. And, you know, you'd have a patient or a PT on each side moving a leg. And I was moving one of the legs that day, and he had all this tone of his plantar flexor, so he's up on his toes. And so I pushed his heel down to the treadmill as the treadmill advanced. And as I pushed his heel down, his opposite hip flexors contracted and advanced his opposite leg. And I'm like, wait a minute, that was weird. And so I did it again, and it happened again. So the dorsiflexion movement of his left ankle was triggering his right hip to contract, which is part of the gait reflex. So our foot lands on the ground, tibial advancement occurs, and the opposite leg swings forward. And that's part of this gait reflex. And it turns out that there's been a whole body of research around these intermuscular reflexes and arthrogenic reflexes that come from joints. Since like the 1940s and 50s, neurophysiologists have been interested in this.
Okay.
And it actually started back in the late 1800s with Sherrington, the father of neuroscience, where he identified the stretch reflex. If you stretch a muscle, it contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And he identified some other reflexes, like the cross extensor reflex. Like if you step on a sharp stone at the beach, what happens? That leg that let's say you step on a sharp stone with your right foot, your left leg extends powerfully, and all of your right leg flexors are activated to pull your foot off of that stone and shift your body weight onto the leg that is standing on a foot that doesn't hurt.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's this, you know, in physiology we call it the limb withdrawal reflex. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful that you cannot override it. Unless you're like, you know, maybe like a Navy SEAL or something. I don't know. Yeah. It's like, but like, I suppose you could like train your brain to override a painful reflex like that. But it's the same thing. You know, you touch a hot flame and the flexors in your hand or in your arm are automatically activated to pull your hand away from that flame.
Right.
So the flexors are activated, the extensors are inhibited from the painful stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a type of proprioceptive. It's a reflex generated by pain.
Mm-hmm.
The proprioceptive reflexes are just as powerful. So when we look at the gait reflexes, for example, there are little mechanical switches that turn on entire groups of muscles. And in the case of walking, that first mechanical switch is at the ankle. And as the ankle goes past a certain range in its motion, the soleus stretches. And as the soleus stretches, that triggers contraction of 14 muscle groups. All of the extensors on that ipsilateral side, including the quads and the glutes, all of the flexors in the contralateral leg, muscles that stabilize the spine, rotate the trunk, swing the arms, and maintain forward gaze.
So if you have a stiff soleus due to overactivity, it's inhibited on
the
other side?
Yes, exactly. So if the soleus is stiff, all of those muscles that are triggered by that gait reflex become inhibited neurologically. In fact, so much so that the quadriceps will lose up to 50% of their recruitment if the soleus is stiff.
Wow.
And the hip extensors will lose somewhere between 50 and 70% of their recruitment if the soleus is stiff.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and I demonstrate this to patients all the time, and in my continuing education courses I demonstrate it. You can measure someone's hip extensor strength, and actually I have a handheld dynamometer that I use right there.
Yeah.
And let's say they hold 25 pounds of pressure. Then I'll manipulate the soleus for a few minutes and then remeasure their hip extensor strength, and it might be triple or quadruple that. It might be up to 100 pounds. And I actually did a research study a couple summers ago looking at runners with unilateral pain, and measured their hip strength before and after soleus manipulation. And on average, their hip strength increased 47%.
Wow.
But in some cases, some of the outliers,
that is so cool,
their hip strength increased 300 to 400% just by manipulating the soleus. So it has a lot of implications to our profession because, you know, how many patients do we have weak hips? I mean, it's like, pick a diagnosis, you'll find that person probably has a weakness in their hip extensors. And so, you know, whether it's an old person who is having difficulty with transfers or whether it's a runner, you know, or a high school soccer player or a ballet dancer, whatever, if stiffness develops in the soleus, their hip extensors will become inhibited.
And we think it's, yeah, we try to strengthen it like crazy, yeah, and nothing happens.
So, right. So this is where the biomechanical model for PT starts to break down, because we're looking at the body and saying, oh, their knee hurts, their Achilles tendon hurts, their hip hurts because the hip extensors are not activating. And because, you know, there's this, you know, if they're not activating, there's too much, you know, varus, sure, torque on the knee or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And so the, so the biomechanical model says, okay, well, let's strengthen those weak muscles. That will help, you know, the hip rotation be more controlled. It will put less stress on the patellofemoral joint or the Achilles tendon, or, you know, help stop them pronating if we can control
all the
hip rotation.
Yep.
Right? And that biomechanical model is legit. I mean, it's real. Yeah. If those hip muscles were stronger, it certainly would probably help that inflammation down the chain. The problem is that we take this largely involuntary skeletal muscle and treat it as if it's 100% voluntary. And all of our skeletal muscles have a voluntary component.
Yes.
But they also have a very powerful reflexive component.
That is fascinating.
Right? And so that reflexive component could be a pain reflex, or it could be a stretch reflex from a muscle, or it could be an arthrogenic reflex from a joint. You know, so
sure.
So there are so many reasons a muscle could actually test weak, and all we think about mostly in the PT profession is it's weak because it's atrophied, or it's, you know, the nervous system's not activating it properly, so we'll exercise it to retrain it. But we're missing this 50% or so of the picture of these involuntary subconscious reflexes.
That is fascinating.
And so,
and
yeah.
you have a course on that,
yeah,
throughout
so,
the body?
Yeah, so I... Yeah, well, long story short.
No,
yeah,
that's
so
great.
So I have two courses that are approved in Michigan right now. One is a really low-risk two-hour course.
Okay.
It's about half seminar and half lab, and I talk about this reflex in particular, the soleus and the glutes.
Cool.
And also one other that I didn't mention, between the soleus and the quadratus lumborum.
Oh.
If the soleus is stiff, the quadratus lumborum spasms, and it creates a pelvic asymmetry with a leg length difference.
Oh.
And on top of that is weakness in the hip extensors. So it's this thing that I call the orthopedic triad: a stiff calf, a leg length difference, and an inhibited glute.
Wow,
something
yeah.
we see in most of our patients.
Yes.
If we're not looking for it, we don't see it.
Right.
Once
yeah.
you start seeing it, it's in everybody.
Wow.
So this two-hour course is just about that. I talk about all the neurophysiology, the neuromechanics, and teach a really simple manual therapy approach to correct it.
That's super cool.
Restore hip recruitment and correct pelvic symmetry in 5 minutes by treating the soleus. And it's like a party trick. It's the craziest thing. And it
people
works.
Are like, that's it?
Yeah, and it works almost every time. That's the really scary
wow.
thing. Anyway, so that's one course. The other course is an 8-hour course.
Okay.
That covers what I call the dirty half dozen, which
Sweet.
Are compensations.
Okay. Love the name.
Thank you. those are compensations that arise from the orthopedic triad. So if the soleus is stiff and the glutes are inhibited and the pelvis is, you know, if there's a anterior or posterior innominate rotation, lots of things go wrong. And there are six really common diagnoses that almost correct themselves when we correct this orthopedic triad. SI joint dysfunction, which, man, how many times, we make that so hard, and it doesn't have to be hard.
Mm-hmm.
all we need to do is get the pelvis to move back into position and stay there, right? That doesn't mm-hmm. sound hard, but
nope.
When you're trying to do it through core stability or other strengthening methods, it can take weeks or months, or it might not even happen.
Because you're fighting a reflex.
Yeah, because you're fighting a reflex that's coming down from the calf.
Yeah.
Right? So yes, anyway, so SI joint issues. This kind of conglomerate of symptoms that I call deep gluteal pain. And that's what some of the research literature has been calling piriformis syndrome or,
okay. You
know, gluteus medius pain. They're just calling it deep gluteal pain because it's like, you know, is it the piriformis? Is it the other external rotators?
Yeah.
Is it the posterior fibers of glute med? What is it? We'll just call it deep gluteal pain.
Yep.
So that's one of the dirty half dozen. IT band syndrome, patellofemoral pain, Achilles tendinopathy, and plantar fasciitis. All six of those are based on my experience and in this research study that I did. They're all compensations that the body tries to use to compensate for the orthopedic triad.
Mm-hmm.
A leg length difference, weakness in the glutes, and a stiff soleus.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does it always start with a stiff soleus, or can it be flipped around?
There are lots of reasons a soleus can stiffen. Injury will cause the soleus to stiffen. For example, there's several research studies that show when they infuse the knee joint with saline solution, mimicking some sort of a knee inflammatory condition
yep. mm-hmm.
or surgery, two things happen. The quads lose 50% of their motor control. This is done by, they're using EMG and some force testing. So the quads lose 50% of their recruitment. If this is just, I think, with like 25 mLs of saline in the knee, right? So the quads shut off. And so this is all happening through central nervous system's mechanisms, right? The central nervous system says, hey, the proprioceptors and the knee joint capsule are all messed up. We're going to shut the quads off to reduce any stress on the knee joint.
It's a safety organ right there.
Right. But if we shut the quads off to reduce the stress on the knee joint, then the knee might buckle. So what we're going to do now is trigger the soleus to contract to stabilize the ankle so the knee won't buckle.
Ah.
So it's a neurological version of an AFO.
Yeah, there you go.
Right? The nervous system gives you an AFO. It tightens your soleus so that the ankle doesn't bend too far forward and your
Absolutely.
Knee doesn't cave, right?
Yeah.
And so...
Man, all these patients are coming to my head right now.
Yeah.
And, oh, man.
Yeah. So now you've got this mechanism for the orthopedic triad to develop. So, you know, someone, basketball player falls and bumps their knee. They get a little bit of swelling underneath their kneecap. Quads shut off. Soleus stiffens. If that lasts a week or two, then the connective tissue fibers in the soleus actually adaptively short. They shorten. We know that only takes it's only a 2-week process.
Mm-hmm.
There's studies done in rabbits where they would immobilize a joint in rabbits, and 2 weeks later, they looked at the connective tissue morphology and the muscles around that joint, and the collagen fibers were thicker and greater in number. So the fibroblasts produce more collagen in a muscle that's not moving. So literally, these muscles will stiffen up. And so if someone sprains an ankle or hurts their knee and their calf tightens up and their ankle stops moving like it's supposed to, just after 2 weeks, that stiffness might become permanent unless we intervene at some point.
Wow.
So if that happens, then, you know, a year later, they're like, oh, man, yeah, my hip and lower back hurt. We look at them and we're like, oh, well, your hip is inhibited, the glutes are inhibited, and there's a leg length difference. And you start asking questions about their history. Oh, yeah, I sprained my knee a year ago, or I sprained my ankle 2 years ago, or like, okay, well, there's the mechanism for why the soleus got tight.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it can, you know, or surgery will induce it too, you know. I just helped a lady after a total knee replacement.
I was thinking that was my primary thing.
They
have no quad control. They have no knee control after
and
a
no
total
hip
knee.
Strength.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it
explains. So with this total knee patient, I mean, she was walking safely without a walker after 2 weeks, and her range of motion was within 3 weeks. She was at 120. And I know that, you know, that that happens, but you know, it was only a 6-week rehab, and she's like 100%. I mean, her operative knee is better than her other knee by far now, 6 weeks after her surgery. And it's just, it's really, you know, I really just focused. I mean, I did a little bit of passive stretching, but mostly it was manually loosening the fascia of her soleus and her quads and working on scar tissue, mobility, you know, some of the normal stuff. But I didn't have to really focus too much on strength with her because I just reactivated her reflexes. And with, you know, her, some general strengthening that I gave her for home, she got stronger. And
but you were able to get her to walk normally again, which is going to facilitate all that strength back.
Exactly. Again. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't spend a lot of time strengthening people. I just say, you know, let's keep these reflexes active and get back to an activity that is going to build your strength.
How often do you are you able to present these courses? Do you have a...
So the 8-hour course I've taught a few times. I actually developed it about 3.5 years ago. And then I went through a bunch of personal problems and ended up, you know, not teaching it for a while. Mm-hmm. And I let it fall down. I also had a 4-hour course on surgical hip and knee rehab.
Okay.
That I taught a few times.
Okay.
And so I just recently got the 8-hour course reapproved through the Michigan
Physical
Therapy Association, and also this 2-hour course. So I just had them approved like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
So I'm actually building a website. It's almost done.
Okay.
It's called neuromechanicspt.com.
Cool.
And it kind of explains some of the history and the philosophy behind it and the courses that I have already approved are up there. And then 2 more courses that I'm getting approved.
And one of them
is a 1-hour webinar that is going to be a free,
okay,
which will be accessible through my website.
Okay.
Still need to work out some of the details on how to download the, you know, certificate of completion.
So are dates for those courses on your the neuromechanics website?
I don't have any dates on the website yet because I haven't solidified any dates.
Okay.
I'm going to be teaching the 2-hour course for sure in February or March down in St. Joe at the Lakeland Hospital.
Oh, Lakeland Hospital.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, with their, I think they have like 100 PTs.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
That'll be cool. I don't have all of them probably. I'll probably have 20 or 30.
Sure. Okay.
So, yeah. So really what I'd like to do is go around and just share the 2-hour course with as many people as possible.
That's cool, yeah.
And it's not even so much that, you know, I don't want to become a guru or something like that. I don't have these...
You'll be flying around the country, speaking to
people.
Well,
no, I would love to fly around the country speaking to everybody about it, but it's not because I want to, like, uplift myself. It's just because I believe our profession is missing something really important, and that piece that's really important is the neurological control of our biomechanics and the biomechanical control of our nervous system. It's this feedback loop that is in constant synergy that
mm-hmm.
I think we just don't see frequently mm-hmm. enough because we're not looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the biomechanical model of PT, I think, needs to shift to the neuromechanical model of PT.
Mm.
That's where the field of biomechanics is going, and I think our field needs to keep up.
That's cool.
And so, you know, taking neuromechanics and learning how to apply that clinically is probably going to be a huge task that will take decades. And it's way beyond me.
It takes like 20 years.
Right. But if I can be part of the impetus to get the concept of neuromechanics out there and how that, you know, we could actually do much better clinically if we learn to apply neuromechanics. Maybe I can be a conduit of some kind, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd really like to attend that. That sounds really cool.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any other courses in your mind in the hopper?
So I have seen in the literature, one of the things that people have a really hard time figuring out is patellofemoral pain. Just not great outcomes, and a lot of times there are no radiographic or MRI positive, you know, signs. So if there's nothing wrong with the joint, why does their patellofemoral joint hurt? That's the big question, right?
Right.
So anyway, I have a 4-hour course that is pending approval right now. And I decided in this course, it's more than just patellofemoral pain. I'm just calling it knee. You know, so it will include some OA, you know, some degenerative joint conditions.
Sure.
I'll throw an IT band syndrome in there too, because it's very related to patellofemoral pain in terms of the neurological mechanism.
Gotcha. Good.
And probably have like a little, you know, 30-minute component of that as a post-surgical knee rehab.
Cool.
Because it all basically ends up being the same neurological treatment, whether it's patellofemoral pain or IT band syndrome or ACL rehab. It's the same issues develop neurologically.
Yeah,
and
sure.
If we fix those, we get all the muscles to turn back on, and they feel better and they function properly. So, yeah.
That sounds cool.
So it's actually a pretty simple approach. It's just a matter of wrapping your brain around how the nervous system is actually controlling these muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And once you figure that out, it's like the treatment actually isn't all that hard. So it's cool. It's not
kind of like PT school. It's not that hard.
Yeah. Well, I guess in contrast, it's not like one of those manual therapy approaches where you have to attend like, you know, a year long intensive residency, you know, and take a decade to master it.
Right.
It doesn't quite feel like that. It's like one of these things where it's fairly intuitive once you see it.
It sounds like it's very applicable as well.
I think it
right
is.
Away,
well,
you know?
I mean, I've built a cash practice on it where I don't market and I see 30 people a week for $130 a pop.
Yep.
And I don't market. And it's not because I'm an amazing PT. It's because this approach works.
There you go.
You know, and on average, I see people 4 times.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
have a few patients who are really, you know, chronic, you know, and I see them once a week, you know,
sure,
for a long time.
Yeah.
But since they're paying out of pocket, I don't even have to worry about, you know, what the insurance company is going to say. It's
right,
just like,
that's right. Exactly. Yep.
So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, first of all, for your time.
Thank you. Yeah.
And thank you so much for your investment in physical therapy.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thanks.
I think we are so much a benefit from you switching from your PhD anatomy professor position to jump right into PT. That's a huge gift to us, that's for sure.
But, well, thank you.
Yeah, and I really would like to go to those courses. That sounds cool.
Oh, so, cool. All right.
But thanks again for your time.
Yeah.
And appreciate it. And if anybody wants to get a hold of you, it's HadleyClinic.com.
HadleyClinic.com, yeah.
And neuromechanics.com?
Neuromechanics PT.
PT.
Yep, all one word.
.com?
Neuromechanics PT.com.
Yep. Cool.
Yep.
Good.
Yeah, and there's actually an email link on my HadleyClinic.com website.
Okay.
If anyone needs to email me.
Cool.
Just get a hold of me that way.
Good.
So.
Well, appreciate your time.
All right.
And thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.